The first serious injuries and house fires caused by now legal fireworks are in our news. This hour, summertime hazards. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. First, I'll talk with the University of Iowa hand surgeon about the many cases of hands and fingers severed by fireworks mishaps he's treated. Just a few days ago, a Davenport teen lost his entire hand to fireworks. Then new research on why all-terrain vehicles are so risky, also bike safety. In the second half hour, common farm-related accidents. And finally, what leads to most boating and swimming mishaps? How to identify and avoid summertime hazards. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Summertime is full of fun, yes, but it's also a season full of hazards of all types. Our mission this hour, how to identify and how to avoid some of the most common hazards at this time of year. Later in the hour, we'll talk about accidents involving ATVs and bikes while swimming and boating, also on farms, agricultural accidents. But first, a hazard that is receiving extra attention in Iowa this summer, fireworks. It's no longer just black snakes and sparklers that are legal. In the 2017 session, the Iowa legislature voted to legalize more powerful fireworks from June the 1st to July 8th. Firecrackers, rockets, Roman candles, now legal. But many cities have set their own rules on when and where they can be shot off or even prohibited them outright. Now, the rules vary depending on where you are, so make sure you check your city or county laws. Of course, fun with more explosive, more impressive fireworks necessarily comes with more risk. Just this morning, news out of Cedar Rapids I read of fireworks causing a two-alarm house fire. No mention in that report of harm to anyone, but of course, fireworks do cause a lot of very serious injuries. Joining me now, Dr. Andre Odobescu. He is a hand, micro, and plastic surgeon. Dr. Odobescu, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me. Hi.
So you have experience treating traumatic hand injuries from fireworks. How much of this have you seen in your practice?
Well, throughout my training, we had some of these. Usually they were illegal. And my fellowship, which was last year, I did in San Francisco at the Bunky Clinic, and we had to deal with pretty much every blast, mangled hands and so on from all over Northern California. So they are very fairly common, especially around 4th of July, unfortunately.
I don't want to be unnecessarily gruesome, but we do need to understand the power of these fireworks. What can the fireworks now legal in Iowa do to someone's hand?
I'm not 100% sure how large the fireworks that are legal in Iowa are. Some of the fireworks are actually quite powerful, like the M80s and things like this, which are, quarter-stick dynamite, basically. So they could, some of them, the more powerful ones, can take your hand clean off. The smaller ones, obviously, they do less damage, but, it's hard to know exactly what damage you're going to experience with a firework.
Can you give us an example of how you've treated a hand injury that was injured by a firework that you've had to do?
Sure, I can give you a couple of examples. We had a gentleman last year who used actually these M80s, which used to be military-grade fireworks, and he blew one hand clean off, and the other one he severely mangled. So one of the hands we could not salvage, we had to amputate it, but the other one we did everything we could to salvage as many digits as he could, because he would be, in a very bad position if he didn't have any kind of hand function at all as a bilateral amputee. So that's one of them. The other one, a bit of a better end result is a child, I think he was about 11 at the time, who was playing with firecrackers, and he lost all the fingers on his dominant hand and half his thumb. So unfortunately, he was actually a very good baseball player, and he wanted to go back to his favorite sport. So once everything settled and we did the damage control initially, we transferred a couple of his toes to make fingers for him so he could actually wear a glove and catch.
Mm-hmm. So better to be, as for function's sake, better to be missing a few toes than to have no fingers to work with, or things that work as fingers.
Hi, absolutely. The toes that we would transfer, they don't have much of a functional impact unless you're a foot model, I suppose. otherwise, for you can play ball, you can run, you can do everything you want, even with the toes missing. Certainly not the case if you're missing multiple digits. One digit, perhaps, two digits, it's already kind of hard. But once you're missing all your fingers, then you can't do much with that hand.
When you have a case of a hand that has been mangled or somehow impaired by a fireworks explosive, and it comes into your clinic, your office, the OR, what do you first want to ascertain?
Well, we first want to know if there's no other, if this was not a confounding injury, if there's no other more severe injuries, since these can affect, your head and neck. You can get, if it goes straight to your face, you could potentially have neck injuries and things that would be life-threatening. Certainly there's burn to the face, there's eye globe injuries, those kind of have priority for us in upper extremity. As long as the patient is not bleeding to death, it's not as critical as for some other parts of the body that are injured by these fireworks. So you certainly want to make sure that you're not focusing on something that appears to be very, exotic as an injury, and oversee something, overlook something that is much more severe and could potentially compromise the patient.
Mm-hmm. What's the difference for you as a hand surgeon when fingers are lost to fireworks compared to when they may be severed?
As a surgeon, I'd rather treat a severed hand from a saw, especially one of those nice, thin band saws. Those are much easier to treat and put back. Unfortunately, the mechanism of injury, when you're having a blast to your hand, the damage is quite extensive, and it involves usually both soft tissue and bone. Your nerves don't recover very well. You get a lot of stiffness. So even in the best of cases, when you can actually preserve the digits, they oftentimes don't work very well. Uh-huh. When they are very badly mangled and just hanging by a thread, so to speak, then oftentimes you unfortunately can't do much for those digits in blast injuries.
If someone listening should be unfortunate enough to be on the site of a blast injury due to a firework this summer, what is the best thing to remember, the initial first aid to give to someone who has sustained an injury of a firework to their hands?
The first thing is you should call 911 and then make sure that the patient is safe, if he's breathing properly, if he's lucid, if he can talk. And then if it's just a hand-related injury, it all depends on how much bleeding it is. They're going to have quite a bit of pain, unfortunately. That's hard to manage on the side of the road or in a backyard. But what we can manage is make sure that the patient is not bleeding to death. So direct pressure is one way you can apply pressure. Obviously, the cleaner the rag or towel or a T-shirt that you have to put pressure on the wound, not the better. The other way, if that's not enough to stop the bleeding, would be to put a tourniquet. For that, either a belt, for example, put at the level of the upper arm and cinched down tightly, or any type of strap-like material that you cinch down tightly, will stop the blood flow to the hand. You have to bear in mind that there's a certain time period that the patient can tolerate that, both from pain point of view and also from his muscles dying. So you can't keep a tourniquet on for hours and hours. They have to be transported quite quickly to a care facility where they can be treated.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that people seem to be a first reflex when you have an injury like this is kind of put it in water, and unfortunately most people around 4th of July, and they tend to be next to water, and it would be a mistake to put that hand or that extremity in a lake or and dirty water, because then the chance of having a severe infection would be much higher.
Mm-hmm. So if you have a cooler of ice, though, that would be a good choice.
Yeah, I would not. Yeah, but it would not help in as much as it will not stop the bleeding, and probably it will help a little bit with the pain. The most important thing is to make sure that the bleeding is controlled.
How much concern, of course, the person's life is the first priority. How much concern should a person in such a situation have for parts of the hand that are no longer attached?
I mean, whenever this happens, we prefer if they pick up the parts that are severed, place them in some kind of moist towel. Unfortunately, you're not going to have any OR compresses or something that we use in the hospital, but put it in a moist towel of some sorts, and then in a Ziploc bag, and then on ice, not in ice, but on ice. That will keep the temperature lower, and it will try to keep this tissue from dying off.
Doctor, now that higher-powered fireworks are legal in this state, do you expect there to be more injuries?
I'm not sure if I can predict that. I think oftentimes when things are illegal, people do as many bad things as when they're legal. And many of the injuries are actually related to homemade fireworks. So I'm not sure if it's necessarily going to decrease or increase the number. Mm-hmm. That we'll only see over the next few years. We know that nationwide, the number of incidents from firework-related injuries have been fairly stable over the last 15 to 20 years.
Can you give us any idea of the number of people who are injured by fireworks every year? I don't know if you have those statistics in your head or a rough idea.
There are about 10,000 hospital visits related to fireworks. Not all of these are necessarily very severe injuries, but it is quite a high number if you think of it, especially around 4th of July and other holidays.
Do you have any advice on how to best avoid fireworks injuries?
Well, the best way is actually not to use them, but if you do feel compelled to use them, then do it safely and try not to keep them in your hand while you light them, and clear the field as far as you can. Before they go off, make sure that they're in a safe position, in a safe place, and there's nobody in the reach of this, either rocket or firecracker or shell and mortar that can be injured, as oftentimes bystanders can be injured by these. The other, I think, my pet peeve with this is that make sure that if you do it, be responsible and keep it away from children. I know some people try to teach children for some reason how to safely use fireworks. It's not as safe, because they can oftentimes just freeze and keep the firecracker in the hand and not throw it away, and then catastrophes happen.
Well, Dr. Andre Odobescu, hand and microsurgeon as well as plastic surgeon, thank you very much for giving us some insights on some of the trauma that you deal with when fireworks go wrong. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Dr. Odobescu from the University of Iowa. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, exploring summertime hazards. Yeah, it's a part of summer, not just fun. You've got to watch out for the hazards, and that's what we're talking about this hour. How to avoid dangers of all kinds at this time of year. Joining us now, Dr. Chuck Jennison is an emergency medicine physician, clinical professor of emergency medicine and pediatrics at the University of Iowa, and works with an ATV simulator, which we'll hear about now. Dr. Jennison, welcome to the program.
Hello, Ben.
Corinne Peek-Asa is back with us, a professor and associate dean for research in the University of Iowa's Department of Occupational and Environmental Health. Corinne, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
Let me turn to Chuck, Dr. Jennison. First of all, we want to sort of focus in on these all-terrain vehicles, other vehicles that we've seen, zooming along open areas on the farms, countryside, but also through the ditches, often teenagers on them, also often very small kids piloting them around at very high speeds. You're involved with ATV research using a virtual reality simulator at the University of Iowa. First of all, before we get to your research, how common, how serious are the injuries caused by these vehicles?
Well, they can be very serious, obviously, fatalities. I think a lot of people would be surprised that more children under 16 years of age in the United States are killed on ATVs than are killed on bicycle crashes. About 700 individuals a year are killed, and there's over 100,000, I would say, ED visits for ATV-related injuries. And so they're a big problem here in Iowa. We see a lot of them at the University of Iowa Emergency Department, and we're trying to prevent those.
Mm-hmm. What have you found using your simulator research or your simulator as a research tool? What makes ATVs so dangerous?
Well, a big part is that they have a high center of gravity, a relatively high center of gravity with a narrow track. So they're made to be off-road vehicles, so they can go between trees and things like that. But that gives them a high center of gravity and makes them much more likely to roll over. In addition, they have off-road terrain tires that are kind of made to grab terrain. So when people go on roadways, they have a tendency to grab both paved and unpaved roads in a kind of unpredictable manner, which can cause them to roll over. And they can go quite fast. These vehicles, much faster than most people could really ever go on an off-road terrain. And so they often take them on the roads, which in many cases is illegal. But even if it's legal, it's not really safe. And more people have died on roadways than anything else. About a little over 60% of all deaths occurred on public roadways in the United States.
So what is a typical scenario of an injury or a serious injury or a death on an ATV on a roadway?
Well, on the roadways, what happens is that people often kind of underpredict what they can do, or you kind of feel like they can go a certain speed and take a curve or a turn and go faster than they anticipate, and then not make it, go into the ditch, roll over, hit an obstacle off the ditch, or roll it on the road. And sometimes a vehicle will roll on top of them. The vehicles have gotten a lot bigger than when I was a kid, and the weight that lands on your neck or your chest, you can't get it off of you, and people often die of traumatic asphyxiation. Head injuries are a big problem. So if you get thrown off and roll over, your head gets hit, and so many people are not wearing helmets. In our studies, injuries, really only about 20% or less are wearing helmets in Iowa. And this is a big concern for deaths is head injuries.
Mm-hmm. So no helmets, no helmet law, and no sort of crash bars or cage that you're in at all in any of these that I've seen anyway.
Yeah, so for regular all-terrain vehicles, they have no roll bars. Yeah, unlike side-by-side vehicles or recreation off-highway vehicles that are a little bit of a different off-road terrain vehicle, they have roll bars and seat belts or harness systems to maintain people in that rollover protective structure environment. But ATVs don't. So you're really vulnerable to extremity injuries, head injuries, and like I said, the vehicle landing on top of you. And if there's nobody else to get it off, you may die from a traumatic asphyxiation problem.
Explain a little bit how the simulator works. I've seen pictures of it actually. Looked like a teen mounted on it, riding what looks to be sitting on an ATV seat, but then a screen and sort of a virtual reality experience for the driver?
Yeah, so at the Center for Computer-Aided Design here in the College of Engineering, my colleague Salam Ramatala, who's an engineer in the College of Engineering, we've kind of put together a ATV simulator, which is the only one really in the world that we're aware of, where somebody can be on the vehicle and actually measure their movements. And ATVs require active riding, which means you have to kind of move around to compensate with changes in center of mass, especially if you're going over an obstacle or on a hill. And so that we can actually look at that, how people operate that on this simulator by using motion capture, like people do for making movies and so forth. You put these little capture,
Sensors.
Yeah, there he goes.
Okay.
Sensors.
Yeah.
And on them, and you can kind of see how they're moving as the ATV is you're negotiating different terrain obstacles. So we can do that, and hopefully in the future we'll be able to look at how inexperienced versus experienced riders, children versus adults, if you're intoxicated, how that affects your ability to do active riding, how passengers affect that, and so forth. Because almost all ATVs are designed for no passengers, and that can affect their operation is another risk factor for injuries.
Can you tell already with the research that others have done and that you have done thus far with this simulator that, whether it's politically feasible or not, that's another question, but would new laws, age restrictions, helmet laws, if you could say my only goal here is to prevent injuries and deaths on these ATVs and ROVs, what would you say needs to happen?
Well, the biggest thing would be is that counties and townships not passing laws that allow them on public roads. We know this is a big risk factor. These vehicles are not designed for roadway travel. The manufacturers specifically state these are off-road vehicles. They're not supposed to be used on the road. And it really puts them at people at high risk, not only, of course, for these injuries we've talked about before, but obviously being hit by a vehicle is a big problem, being on roadways, which is not when you're off-road. And so that would be the biggest thing, is that counties and municipalities not pass these type of laws. Certainly helmet laws would also be helpful in encouraging people to wear helmets and prevent serious head injuries.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know, Dr. Jennison, if you're a parent or not, but there are plenty of parents listening, perhaps some with ATVs or other similar vehicles that they let their children use. What would be your advice?
Well, in our we do a school program related to ATV safety called STARS program, Safety Tips for ATV Riders. And in that program, we encourage people to ride the right size machine. So a lot of our adult size machines that are not for kids less than 16 years of age, but children are allowed to ride them by their parents. And so to stay off of those type of adult machines for children, one person at a time, always wear a helmet, don't ride on the road. Those are really some of the key things that really parents should try to do. And, supervision is important, but just watching them doesn't necessarily make them safe. And so, but it also helps prevent kids from doing crazy things, things that they shouldn't be doing, and really making certain that they're following certain safety rules, like wearing their helmet and not riding for passengers.
Do we have any sort of a patchwork of different laws when it comes to ATV riders in the state, county to county?
Well, they kind of vary right now. Of course, being on the road is quite variable throughout the state. We do have a law that no ATV is just for single riders, that you should not have passengers on it. That's a law we have throughout the state, both public and private land. So a law that a lot of people don't know about, but it is against the law to ride with passengers in our state, and certainly something we would encourage. We know that kids, especially on the back of the seats, they often get ejected to the rear, and that the risk for a head injury is actually kind of greater if you get ejected to the rear because you have a hard time protecting your head.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Stay with us. Dr. Chuck Jennison is with us, emergency medicine physician working with an ATV simulator at the University of Iowa. Corinne Peek-Asa with us. We haven't had a chance to talk with you. We want to talk with you, Corinne, about bike safety specifically. We're talking about summertime hazards. We're going to take a short break. Also, later this hour, we'll talk about common farm-related accidents and what leads to most boating and swimming mishaps. Summer is a lot of fun, but there are hazards out there, and we're addressing them this hour. Perhaps you'd like to share your experience with summer hazards, a personal experience. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. I'm Ben Kiefer, back after a short break. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We know summer means fun, but it also is full of hazards. We're talking about the hazards that are most common out there during these summer months and how to avoid them. We have with us Dr. Chuck Jennison, emergency medicine physician at the University of Iowa. Corinne Peek-Asa is a professor and associate dean for research at the UI's Department of Occupational Environmental Health. Talking about ATV research, these vehicles that primarily meant for for off-road, but are used a lot on the road, and that's where they can be dangerous. I want to talk with Corinne just a minute about some bike safety aspects. But first of all, Joe is joining us from Waterloo calling in. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the program. We're moving along at a quick pace during this hour, but what do you want to chip in?
Well, thank you. Enjoy your program a great deal.
Thank you.
So several years ago, a friend of mine, Scott Faub, was a researcher for DOT, and he conducted an analysis examining the question of increased motorcycle fatalities and injuries that were happening at the same time that other motor vehicle fatalities and injuries were in the decline. And what he found was that this increase was due largely to older motorcycle enthusiasts who had perhaps returned to using motorcycles, and then they, you know, the motorcycles of today are larger and faster, they're heavier, whereas the older population, let's say baby boomers such as me, have slower reactions and are not as strong as we were in our youth. Okay. And this was coupled with these drivers not wearing helmets,
mm-hmm.
and the combination of these factors was causing an increase in motorcycle fatalities and injuries. And I just wonder if your guests have anything to say about that, and especially whether it's time for a more, you know, a public awareness campaign directed toward older motorcyclists. Thank you for taking my question.
Joe, thank you for calling in from Waterloo. I think, Corinne, you wanted to jump in on this aspect, the good points that Joe brought up here.
Absolutely, Joe. And so I actually worked quite closely with Scott Faub. He was a great contributor to the Department of Transportation. And I know the study that you're talking about, and we're very interested in looking at increases in motorcycle fatalities and injuries in Iowa. So Scott's report also found a disproportional increase on rural roads. And we've known for a very long time that motorcycle crashes, single vehicle crashes are often related to the operator error, sometimes alcohol on board. But when there's a crash with a motor vehicle, it's usually the fault of the passenger car and less so the motorcyclist. And so definitely we need awareness campaigns. And we probably also need to bolster our motorcycle education courses, because you can often not need a lot of new education if you've ridden a motorcycle before and are adding a rider to your license. And I think we need to address the issue of helmets in our state, even if we're not open to a helmet law, which has been very problematic in our state. We need to promote helmet use.
We're in a very small minority, aren't we? How many states require helmets?
Well, there are about 26 that have universal laws, which are really the most effective, which is everyone on a motorcycle needs to wear their helmet. 18 other states have partial laws, which may be just young riders. We are the only state that has actually turned down federal highway money because we don't want to implement a helmet law. Iowa has had one, but was only on the books for about 9 months.
Corinne, let's take the motor off those two wheels and talk a little bit about bike safety. Of course, bike accidents have been around with us for a long time. Do you have any stats, or can you tell us how common serious bike accidents and deaths are in the state?
Yes, they are very common and very serious. And I will say that, you know, we like any two-wheeled vehicle, but the goal, especially, you know, with bicycles, which are such a great activity and great form of transportation, is to encourage their use, but in the safest conditions possible. And so we have several hundred fatalities every year, and then many thousands of hospitalizations.
Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, kids, when they ride bikes, they're different. They're a little lawless, if I can say it that way, careless, a bigger risk takers. What do we know about that, according to our research?
Yeah, well, just as Chuck has his first with the ATV simulator, the Injury Prevention Research Center has a first in conducting the first observational study of bicycle riding in children. And that was led by Dr. Kara Haman, who worked with our College of Engineering to develop an instrumented bicycle so we can actually record and geomap kids and adults riding. And we're the first place in the world that has done a study like this looking at kids. And yes, they ride very differently. When we think about kids riding bicycles, they have very little experience being a traffic user. So they haven't driven a car. They haven't even done a lot of unsupervised walking, sometimes really negotiating the traffic environment. And so they generally use their bicycles in two ways that pose different kinds of risks. One is using their bike as a toy. So they'll chase each other with it. They'll have races. Their goal is really not to move from point A to point B. And the biggest risk in that is when, at least for severe injury, is when that play moves into the street and they're not watching for cars because their brains are really focused on the fact that they're playing. So they have a hard time moving away from that and looking at the traffic environment. The second big issue with them using bikes for transportation is they don't have experience deciding where to ride on the road, in the middle of the road, on the sidewalk. Is there a bicycle facility? Again, because they're naive about the traffic environment. So one thing parents can do to really help their kids is to think about route choice. What is the safest route from point A to point B? Mm-hmm. Where should they be on the sidewalk? Where should they be on a bicycle path? What are the rules on the bicycle path for right-of-way? And, you know, rules of right-of-way are things you usually don't learn until driver's education. And we really need to talk to our kids about that with bicycles.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if the improvements communities have been making around the state in varying degrees, better bike paths, dedicated bike paths, painted bike lanes, how much safer does that make biking?
It makes a very big difference, and for two different reasons. So, for example, we have done some research that shows that roadways that have bicycle facilities have higher bicycle use but lower crashes per mile. So bicycle facilities are a good thing. Removing bicyclists on separate lanes takes away some of the risk for motor vehicle involvement, which is the leading cause of very severe injury and fatality. And what we also notice is that the more sophisticated the rider, the more they'll alter their route to be in a facility. So I think that the other way these work, in addition to being effective, is that there's, you know, some indicators of traffic safety culture that the places that implement them are also more friendly for bicyclists. And that has an impact on how car drivers yield the right-of-way to a bicyclist, how welcoming we are to bicycles as a sharing the roadway.
Okay. Let's go back to our phones quickly to Susan in the Cedar Rapids area. Do you have a hazard, summer hazard experience to share? Susan, welcome to the program.
Yes, I have a cousin that was killed in an all-terrain vehicle accident, and he was on the front and his brother was on the back, and which you just said should not happen. And the other thing is that he turned too sharply and went straight into a telephone pole and died almost instantly. And, you know, and I'm scared to death of this kind of stuff, and I would never let any of my kids, you know, on something like that. It's just, you know, they're just too terrifying.
Yeah. Susan, so, thank you very much for the call. Very sorry to hear about your cousin, but thank you for sharing that experience so that others can pass on the caution that's necessary with these vehicles. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. Let's talk, if you just joined us, we're talking about summer hazards and safety, how to avoid those hazards. Let's add to our conversation Brandy Jansen, clinical assistant professor at the University of Iowa's Department of Occupational and Environmental Health. Brandy, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I see here you write regularly for Iowa Farmer Today, and we're having you on to talk specifically about agriculture or farm-related accidents. Can you give us, first of all, a rough idea of how many people on Iowa farms are injured or killed every year?
Well, farming is definitely hazardous all year round. We know across the Midwest, so in, say, our about 9-state region, we see about 230 fatal injuries every year on farms. And in Iowa, most years, agriculture is responsible for more occupational fatalities than any other industry or job site, and that's roughly about 30 per year. Non-fatal injuries are a little harder to keep track of because they're not always clearly indicated as farm-related, but in general, the trend is we've been seeing non-fatal injuries increasing over time in Iowa.
I had the opportunity to interview an Iowan who had a non-fatal injury, very serious injury, a couple of years ago. Let's listen to a little excerpt from my conversation with him. Rick Meister is a Northwest Iowa farmer, been farming his whole life, now 55 years old. In 2014, Rick was involved in a combine accident that took both of his legs. Here's a portion of my conversation with Rick from 2015.
Well, in the last Labor Day, we had some wind come through and it blew the corn down, and I was going through to open up the cornfield because we feed cattle and we were going to yearleage it. The head got plugged, and I have an older combine that where you get up, that don't shut off automatically and stuff. And I left the machine running and went out and unplugged the head. And then when I was unplugging the head, my left leg got caught in the gathering chain, and then so did my right one, went in there too and stuff. And everything. Mm. So
horrible. What did you think at that moment?
Oh,
that was the end?
I had about 5 seconds to hold myself back. I was going to go all the way through the machine, yes. Mm. It was horrible.
How did you manage to save your life?
I pressed myself against the head, and good thing my boy, he works as a loan officer at a bank, was following me. Otherwise, I would have bled to death. Mm-hmm. They put tourniquets on me right away. They took their belts off and put their tourniquets around my legs. They were cut off below the knee, one was, and the other one was partially cut off. But then when we got to the hospital, the knees were so bad, they cut them off above the knees. They took both of them.
Mm-hmm. How are you getting along in your first year without most of your legs?
I think pretty good. I'm walking with prosthetics and stuff already, and I get around. I still do farm work. The boys have made an invention of something to get me up in the tractor, and I did all the field work this spring in front of them. We have hand controls in the tractors that, you know, I stop. And a lot of these tractors anymore, you don't need the clutch or brakes to actually stop. You know what I'm saying? It's all in the transmission and stuff you can do it with.
Mm-hmm. What is your takeaway about the nature of accidents, the nature of this accident?
It just happens so quick, and it's just a reminder that farming, it's a danger all the time. It don't matter what you're doing. You know, you sit back, and I had my neighbors come to visit me in the hospital, you know, and we're talking about it. It's whatever piece of equipment you pick up, there's a danger. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
There's something that could go wrong that we don't know about. Yeah, you don't want it to, but it could happen.
Rick Meister, a conversation I had with this Northwest Iowa farmer in 2015. Brandy Jansen, a lot packed in there in that experience, really a lot to learn from, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And this particular time of year, combines are less of a risk, but I would say balers, people out working hay and baling hay, the potential to be pulled into a piece of equipment is a real risk. I think the other thing from Rick's story is that he had people with him. So one risk factor in farming is that people often work alone, and they often work great distances from their home or even from the road. So if something does happen, either people don't know about it, which in Rick's case, of course, would have been catastrophic for him, more catastrophic, or they can't be found because people don't know where they are. So we always recommend that if you must work alone, check in with people regularly, have sort of a call schedule so that you're not left in a bad situation.
Brandy, you and your colleagues, I understand, work on some educational outreach to help make farming areas safer. It's called ICASH, Iowa Center for Agricultural Safety and Health. We don't have much time, but what are your biggest challenges? What are the messages you're trying to get across?
Well, there are so many, and they're always complex, but be aware of working alone. Make sure that all of your equipment is well-maintained and all the shields and guards are intact, because machinery and equipment are major injury causers. This time of year, thinking about livestock shows at fairs, being aware of livestock behavior and good handling practices with livestock.
Okay. Thank you very much, Brandy Jansen of the University of Iowa. We appreciate your expertise sharing information about safety on the farm. Thanks, Brandy.
Sure. Good to be here.
Finally, the end of the hour, we've looked at an hour in which we've looked at common summertime hazards, how to avoid them. Let's talk about dangers, of course, involving water. Sadly, another report from this past weekend of a drowning, this one at Lake Panorama. A 19-year-old man kayaking somehow ended up in the water, drowned. He was not wearing a life jacket. Susan Stocker is with us, a boating law administrator and education coordinator for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Hi, Susan.
Hello there.
Well, comment on this latest drowning victim. The vast majority of drowning victims don't wear life jackets, right?
That is correct. Unfortunately, even though there's many, many life jackets varieties out there and they're comfortable, people are not wearing them.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about boating. The biggest hazards to boaters out there?
Well, one of the hazards that we might find in the spring and after heavy rains that we have is a lot of debris and or, you know, floating logs or things in the water. So people truly need to look out for that. And all of the passengers need to become the lookout for the operator so that everybody is safe.
Right. And I know if you're on a river in a kayak or a canoe, whatever kind of craft, these, even if you're aware of them, I was aware of these dangers. And a few years ago, I was capsized in a kayak at the on the Upper Iowa River when I suddenly rounded a bend and faced a downed tree that was blocking most of the river. There forced me against the tree, actually pushed me down as I hit the tree, and then you realize, Susan, the great force that these rivers have.
Exactly, and as we see more and more, as maybe the bank is eroding or whatever, you will find the downed trees, and as you found out, all of that rushing water is going into what we call into the strainer or forces you toward that downed tree or the snag that might be there. So certainly, and you may have been paddling or on that water body a week ago, and things change rapidly.
Yes.
So truly need to be aware of it.
Right. Let's talk quickly about low head dams. They're hard to see. You're going down a river. You didn't really scout out the river that you're going down, and then all of a sudden you're right up on a dam. They're very dangerous.
They are very dangerous, and Iowa has several of them throughout the state. And the reason they're called low-head dams is because, of course, you look down the horizon of the river, and you can't see it, as you mentioned. But they are recirculating, so the current will take you over the dam and then keep you trapped in the recirculating mechanism. So certainly wearing your life jacket will allow you to resurface once you are forced under the water. And then what you need to do is, if you can, kick off the bottom if you find the bottom of the river and or swim downstream. But it's very, very dangerous.
Right. If you have your wits about you in that sort of situation to find the bottom and kick off of it, wear your life jacket is the best advice there. Quickly, we know drunk, intoxicated boaters, a big problem still, right, Susan?
It is still a big problem, and so we want to make sure that everybody has a designated driver. You know, we know that boating is fun and recreating, but unfortunately, Iowa, the fatality rates for boating is higher than on a national level. So nationally, 17% of the fatalities involve alcohol, and unfortunately, in Iowa, last year in 2016, 33% of our fatalities involved alcohol. So we want to make sure that the waters are safe for everybody and leave the alcohol at home and have a designated driver.
Mm-hmm. Swimming. We love to swim in our lakes and rivers, right? What are precautions you need to take there?
We certainly do. And again, the lakes and rivers are continually changing. So make sure if you are even just wading in a river or lake, wear your life jackets, because if you step off the shore and into the water and you're into a deep hole, then the current could potentially take you down river and, like you had mentioned, force you into that snag area. And also, you know, the common swimming practices, always swim with a buddy. Make sure, as we heard last presentation, make sure you let people know where you're at.
Right. You know, people who live near oceans have to worry about riptides and so forth. But we have our rivers there. And as you mentioned there, we've had some tragic instances of families picnicking next to rivers and letting the younger ones just sort of, what they think, go up to their knees, maybe their waists in the water. Mm-hmm. They are dangerous out there, some of the currents, right?
They are, and so you just need to be, of course, as you know, respect nature, respect the water, and be familiar with where you're at, and be safe about it.
Right. At the DNR on your website, you have some safety information?
We do. So we certainly encourage everybody to take a boating safety course, and it provides information for even the people that have been boating all of their life. It's more about individuals being aware of potentially what could happen from the boater that isn't as knowledgeable, so that you can react and save an accident or save any injuries that might happen.
Okay, thank you very much. Susan Stocker with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Thank you for some tips on avoiding the hazards of water.
Thank you very much.
Also, thanks to Dr. Chuck Jennison of the University of Iowa, emergency medicine physician, for coming to our studio. Doctor, thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
And Corinne Peek-Asa, always good to have you on the program to share your expertise. We could have talked a lot longer about this, but hopefully we raised some awareness and we'll be enjoying our summer fun in a safe way. Thank you both for coming into our studio.
Thanks, Ben.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon. We'll help today from Helena Thompson as well. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow is Politics Day. Hope you'll join us for that. I'm Ben Kiefer. Talk again tomorrow.